From the City Opera House, welcome to the final program of the 2010 Traverse City National Writers Series. New York Times best-selling authors Carl Marlantis and Philip Caputo share the stage for a riveting conversation on the Vietnam War. Caputo and Marlantis have authored two of the most influential books ever published on Vietnam. Caputo's memoir, A Rumor of War, has sold more than 2 million copies, and Marlantis' fictional opus, Matterhorn, debuted this year at number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list. The house lights have dimmed. Philip Caputo and Carl Marlantis are on stage ready to begin their conversation. Philip Caputo serves as the host for this evening's program.
Well, I think as you saw in the program, I am the host tonight. This is the first time I've been a host. I really do believe that Matterhorn will be seen in the future and in not too long a time as perhaps the great novel of the Vietnam War. And beyond that, it's just simply not only a great novel about the Vietnam War, not only a great war novel, because it really exceeds its genre, it's a great novel. And I think it'll stand with the Red Badge of Courage and All Quiet on the Western Front and the Thin Red Line. And so why do I say that? Well, I think there's a couple of reasons, but one of the main reason is goes back to something William Styron told me in a conversation I had with him quite some time ago in the mid '80s, and he had said that great literature is a trinity of narrative, language, and character, but the greatest of the three is character. That the whole art of creating great fiction is the art of creating characters whom no one will ever want to cast into oblivion. And I think that what makes Matterhorn such a great novel are the characters in it and their relationships. That I don't know that if any of you have finished it yet or read all of it, but characters like Jankowitz, China, Jackson, Mole, Lieutenant Colonel Simpson, who's the alcoholic battalion commander, and then the protagonist, Lieutenant Wayno Mellis, and his arc from a kind of a self-centered, ambitious bit of a glory hound into someone who is, instead of being brutalized by the experience of combat, is actually made more compassionate. To use the tired cliche, when I was reading Matterhorn, I could not put it down. And I think I would have felt that way even if I had not been in Vietnam or had any experience of war at all. The only caveat I had on that is that because of my experience in Vietnam, I would not read the book at night. I always confined my reading to daytime, kind of afraid of the little ghosts that might come around. So, on to some questions, and I know, Carl, you've got to be really sick of this question. But, you know, I mean, there's guys that worked at the Ford plant for 35 years, right? And first of all, well, why did it take you that long? And could you describe how you got yourself through the writing of it for such a long period as that?
Well, is this working? Good. All right. Yeah, the description of trying to get this book published, I mean, the reason it took 35 years was not because it took me that long to write it. It was just that no one would ever publish it. And I was telling people at dinner tonight, I said that my first novel was what I refer to as a psycho dump, which was I came back from the war. It was a first person 1700 manic typewriter, really bad. But I got a lot of stuff out of my system so that I could actually start writing fiction. And I finished the draft in 77, and I started to try and sell it. And apparently I can write a novel, but not query letters, because no one would read the book. And I don't, how do I put this? There's a very difficult marriage between art and commerce, and I think any artist has to face that. Your work doesn't get out to the people unless the business people think they can make a profit off of it, and that's just the way it works, and that's fine. In 1977, nobody thought anybody wanted to read about the Vietnam War, especially in a very big fiction piece, you know, look at, as it's been referred to as a doorstopper, right? And so no one would read it. And then I have five children, and so I had the first two of the five by that time, and I had to start figuring out how I was going to straighten their teeth and earn a living. And so I put the book aside for a while, and then I'd start working on it again, and I made another run at it by the mid '80s, and the feedback that came back then was they still didn't want to read it, and the reason was is because, well, Hollywood's already done it. Full Metal Jacket, Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter, it's like, there's no market, Vietnam's over, okay? And by the 90s, when I ginned up enough courage, and I kept working on it, and I'll have to admit this, if the book had been published when I wanted it to be published, it's one of those, be careful of what you want, you may get it, it wouldn't have been half the book that it is today, because I was, I wrote it, the first draft, when I was like 25, and I was not a very mature guy at age 25, and 30 years of getting beat up by life, it does teach you a few things, and my characters, I think, were much deepened by the experience of me just getting older. What they learn in 3 months, it took me 3 decades. So anyway, by the mid-90s, I would try it again, and those that would deign to answer my query letters said, well, why don't you just switch it to the Gulf War? Maybe we could sell that. I thought to myself, it's really great that Microsoft Word had come along, because I can do search and replace and just do desert for jungle, it would be just psst, and the whole new thing. And then by the aughts, it was, it's got a mountain in it, right? Afghanistan's got mountains. Why don't you just move it to Afghanistan? You can have these guys. And it just isn't that easy. The way it got published was, and I love to tell this story because it's so counterintuitive, it was actually a group of women that got this book, in its current form, which, I was in despair. And a friend of mine was reading the manuscript after all my query letters, reading the books, which you writers out there know them. It's like, how to find the agent who will sell your book for you, write the killer query letter. It bounced off my head. This friend of mine's reading the manuscript. He gets a phone call from an old friend of his who teaches writing at Berkeley. And this old friend, Tom Farber, had started a very small literary house called El Leon Literary Arts. And the purpose of this nonprofit literary house was to get literature into the marketplace, because it's very hard to get good literature into the general marketplace because of this difficult marriage between commerce and art. So my friend says, hey, I've got this great manuscript. And I'm sure Farber rolled his eyes, because everybody's got a friend with a manuscript if you're a publisher. And he said, well, give it to my senior editor, Kit Duane, and she'll take a look at it and get the monkey off of my back. And so my friend calls me on the phone, and I can remember the night he called, because he was very excited. He says, Carl, this old friend of mine started this nonprofit literary house in Berkeley, and he says, he wants to send it to a senior editor. And I said, wait a second, Ken. I said, this is a big book. It's going to cost me $50 at Kinko's to make a copy of this thing. And it's about Marines in Vietnam, and you want me to send it to a woman in Berkeley, California? He shamed me, and he said, I'll pay for the copying. God, send it to her. And I said, okay, I'll pay for the copying. And she was the first person that read the book through, and she loved it. And she talked to Tom, who's the publisher, and they decided to publish it. And the way that a nonprofit generally works and is that they get enough money to make a small run. In this case, it was 1,200 copies. And my pay was 10% of them, 120 free copies that I could sell to my friends, you know, whatever I wanted to do. And they don't do advanced readers' copies. They just make a run, and you just do what you can do. And so I said, great, now I've got a product. I can go to New York, and I can show them that it's an edited book, and it's same reaction. You know, it's like, you know. And so my wife, woman number two, comes up with the idea. She says, well, look, the problem is no one reads it. Yes. Get El Leon to enter it into contests, because if these people have any integrity, they'll have to read at least 10 pages of this thing, and maybe they'll get hooked, and maybe they'll, you know, continue. And I said, that's great. So El Leon submitted it to the Barnes & Noble Discover Great Writers contest. And a woman, I think, in Milwaukee, they have volunteers and their staffers to read new writers. She loved this book, and she sent it up the chain to Jill Lamar, who is the head of that program, and she loved this book. And she sent it to Cecily Hensley, who is sort of like the Oprah of the publishing world, because she's the chief fiction buyer for Barnes & Noble. And she went, and she realized that if Barnes & Noble chose me, which they did, as I'm one of the five, whatever they chose this year, and that they'd bury El Leon. And so she took it to New York publishers. And of course, they set up right away, because, you know, they knew that Barnes & Noble wanted to buy this book. And I'd like to make a big plug for Morgan Entrekin of Grove Atlantic. All he had to do was buy all those copies, because he hadn't started selling them yet, except for me going around in my car. And I sold some at my old high school. And I did. There were two kids. I said, hey, you know, $25. It's a good deal, you know. But now they're collector's copies. I didn't do them bad, you know. But anyway.
Lucky the cops did.
That's right, I know.
What's in that book?
That's right. All he had to do was buy them, and that got me out of my contract with El Leon. And so he did buy them all, and they're in a warehouse someplace in Hayward, I think. But he also paid all their printing costs, and he included them as a percentage of the sales. And you'll see it's a joint venture here between El Leon and Grove Atlantic. And so when you buy the book, you're going to be supporting new writers, because a percentage of this goes to El Leon Literary Arts, and they, of course, are in the business of getting fiction published so that it can go in the marketplace. And so that's sort of the story of how it finally came to be.
Well, you know, there's a kind of a odd parallelism here, that A Rumor of War was one of the first books to come out of its nature, anyway,
right,
about Vietnam, and which is now 35 years ago, and yours is well, the latest. I can't say the last, but the latest one. Now, I had an experience that when I wrote A Rumor of War, and I was amazed finally when I got a publisher, because I had not quite the experience you did, but I did have a lot of publishers turned it down, several of them. And then even Henry Holt & Company, or then called Holt, Reinhardt & Winston, the editor there said that it sat on her desk for a month before she could get up the nerve to read it. Because as I've often thought, is that back in the 70s, if you said, I've got this memoir, this novel about Vietnam, it was like writing about explicit sex in 1850.
That's right, yeah. I mean,
nobody wanted to touch it. And so then I finally got the publisher, and then I remember my wife had asked me, she says, my advance was like $6,000, which even in 1977 wasn't a lot of money. And she says, what do you think will happen? I said, I think it'll probably earn out the advance, and then maybe we can take a holiday somewhere. And so it turned out to be very, very successful. And it got, you know, big reviews in the New York Times and all over. And I was amazed. Now, I was wondering, your book, Matterhorn, got, I think it was the front page in the New York Times,
right,
book review, which is a big deal. By the way, have never gotten that. I'm going to find out.
You sold 2 million copies, so that's all right. Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, were you overwhelmed by that kind of response, the critical and popular response to it?
I was surprised. I mean, I can remember when that came out. Sebastian Younger wrote the review, and it was sent to me over the internet, a PDF file, and I looked at it. And I remember shouting upstairs to my wife. I said, "Ann, I think the kitchen remodel is going to happen." and so that was very, very pleasing. And I remember my kids used to ask, we'd say, well, you know, where's Dad? He's in the basement working on his book. It's just what they grew up with, this book. And my relatives, you know, and honestly, I caught a couple of them. They don't know it was like, oh, Carl's book. Oh, God, you know, the eyes rolling. And I was like, because it just became a family thing, you know, it's Carl's book. But, you know, I remember my kids asking me how would you feel that you were successful with this? And I said, if I can get people who I respect to review it and say I did a good job, I could get run over by a bus the next day, and I'd go out happy. And a guy named John Stallworthy, who's a wonderful poet in England, read this book and gave it a really good review. Sebastian Younger gave it a good review. And then it started getting all these good reviews. And so I just have said that is an unbelievable feeling of success for me. And I did not expect it to be as much as it was. But overwhelmed is not the right word, because I think surreal is the right word. Because, you know, I still go home and, you know, pick the dog poop up out of the lawn and put the, you know, they take the garbage up to the curb, and it's like, you know, I say, don't you know I'm a famous writer? How come I, you know, why get this?
You know, how's the kitchen?
That's right. Yeah, we haven't even started that yet. But so that's a real different feeling. It's a surreal feeling. It's like, gosh, I mean, they're talking about me.
Well, Matterhorn was also, I think, it debuted at number 7 on the Times bestseller list. And I mean, anybody, when you look at the Times bestseller list, it is almost exclusively kind of John Grisham thrillers.
Vampires.
And vampires. You know.
But I was thinking if I could bring back some of my characters that I killed off as vampires, yeah. I could do the second, the undead.
Yet vampires.
No, right? My editor, Jofi Ferrari Adler, yeah. Who's a wonderful editor, he called me on the phone, and I can never forget, he says, Carl, he says, you're new in this business. He says, you don't know how rare it is to get a real book on that list.
Well, that I was going to say, it is. Yeah. And I think it was amazing. And what continues to surprise me is the resonance that mm-hmm. war and the writing about it continues to have in our culture even today. And what do you think accounts for that? It quite amazes me.
I think a couple of things account for it. One is that the generation that lived through what in our lifetimes is the greatest divide that this country has ever faced since the Civil War. We just stopped short, and I mean just short, of killing each other in the 60s. I mean, there were things going on in Watts and Detroit, and there were snipers, and I mean, it was close. People forget that, how divisive it was with the racism, and then the conflict over the war, whole generational issues. It was incredibly divisive. I mean, the Chicago, you know, Democratic Party convention, just try and remember back. And that divide in our, it's not the war per se, it's the division in our culture that happened, has been, I think, the elephant in the room. It's like, you know, we don't talk about Dad's drinking, right? We talk about, we have a good car. You know, I mean, you know, just anything except that. And people don't want to talk about that, but it influences our foreign policy. It influences our politics to this day, that divisive act that happened because of the Vietnam War. And I think that, you know, let's face it, we're at an age now where the testosterone levels are down, and, you know, we can actually reflect on things. And so, you know, and it's, people are sort of going like, wow, you know, what happened back then? I mean, we're sort of like, you know, you get through with raising your kids and nose to the grindstone, and I think that the general population of the states is more receptive to thinking about the elephant in the room and maybe even talking about it. Mm. And the second thing, which I think reverberates strongly, especially because I get so many questions about it when I'm out doing my readings, is the eerie parallels between Vietnam and Afghanistan. I mean, you can go down the list. It's they can go across the border. We can't chase them. We stick out like sore thumbs, don't understand the culture, can't speak the language. The Taliban does all of those things. We're supporting a corrupt government. We have very strict rules of engagement. They have no rules of engagement. I mean, the parallels are eerie. And we're now in the same situation that we faced in Vietnam, which is we can choose to stay there for the next 5 decades, or we can abandon our allies. I mean, this is a very sad place to be, and I think that this book is bringing a lot of that up too. And I don't, the book doesn't give any answers to that. I just wish they, people who made the policy decisions, had remembered some of that stuff.
But I think you have addressed why this event, which now, let's face it, is that it's what nearly.
Yeah, a long time ago.
35, 40 years ago since the fall of Saigon, and I think it continues to reverberate. I know that when during the 2004 presidential elections, there was all that controversy that was aroused by the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth about John Kerry, and I got a call from a political reporter at the Houston Chronicle asking for my comments on this, and he was about 35 years old, and he said, you know, he says, I don't get it. He said, we're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan now, and he says, and why are all you guys still arguing right about Vietnam? And he says, is it ever going to be over? And I said, yeah. I says, when the last baby boomer dies, and I think that that's true. Is that the 60s were kind of a rift in our culture and our image of ourselves.
Yeah.
Vietnam was at the center of that earthquake, if you want to call it.
Definitely.
And it continues to have these aftershocks.
You know, but I'm not pessimistic about it. I had that same opinion. It was sort of like the Civil War generation. I mean, it really did take the death of all those veterans before it finally started to even out. It still hasn't evened out. I was at Berkeley. I mean, I had this, for some reason, like this karma with Berkeley. It's a very wonderful little independent bookstore called Mrs. Dalloway's. I mean, how much more innocent can that sound? Wanted me to do a reading. And so my publisher, you know, called me and said, well, you know, we got you set up at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley. I said, you what? You're going to send me to Berkeley? And, you know, I mean, I can charge the hill in Vietnam, but I'm not going to go down to, you know. And I mean, I was seriously worried because I didn't know what kind of a reception I was going to get, and I went, you know, I said, okay, I'll do it, you know, and I went to this little bookshop, and it was stuffed with people. I mean, people were outside on the street, and probably 95% had been anti-war protesters when they were young, and the feeling in the room was one of, I don't know what the right word is, reconciliation. Trying to understand what was happening, they started asking me questions. And after about 3 or 4 questions, they started talking to each other in this room, this bookstore. It was like, well, I thought this at the time, and I don't know why I behaved like that, but what did you, I mean, back and forth. And so, I mean, I had this incredible feeling of these people are here seriously trying to understand a big part of not just the culture's life, their own personal lives. And I went, yay for literature. You know, that's what brought them there and got them talking. And I'm hopeful that, I mean, literature is a big tool for getting people to step into someone else's skin. I had this, another reading, woman came up to me and she's sort of dancing around and, you know, it's like a little bit sort of embarrassed. And she says, well, you know, I was an anti-war protester. I was in college during the time of the Vietnam War. And I read your book and this is a little embarrassing, but I didn't know you guys slept outside. College educated woman. But that's how big the divide was and still is in this nation. So that's reaching out, and that makes me feel good.
Well, I'm along those lines is that one of the differences in the literature of say two conflicts, if you take World War II and you take Norman Mailer, James Jones, Joseph Heller, Kurt Vonnegut, and Erwin Shaw, They wrote about an experience that was shared by the entire culture, the entire nation. So when James Jones would write The Thin Red Line, or From Here to Eternity, or Norman Mailer wrote The Naked and the Dead, the general population could relate to it.
Right.
Even though they were describing alien experiences. But with the war we were in, it was not only was the war the alien experience, but it was so divorced from the experience of the ordinary American population. I think you've got a line in the book there that, but where these guys are going into battle and they in effect depart from the world that ordinary people don't share with them, or they don't share with ordinary people. Well, anyway, what I want to know is that did you have special like narrative problems in trying to get that experience across to people whom you know never had it, that there were no common touch points?
Right. Yeah, it was probably the most difficult chapter was the first chapter, because I wanted to try and my view of literature is you drop someone into someone else's skin and then they expand their own lives. And I had this experience, just we got into later reading Eudora Welty. I got into a woman's skin in the 1920s on a Mississippi Delta plantation. It was like, God, I see the world differently. And so I have that feeling. So the artistic problem was the reason you have genre war novels, the sort of shoot 'em ups, is because the part about war that's exciting that, you know, people, probably mostly guys, will read about is one tiny, tiny percentage, and you and I both know that. Most of the time, war is tedious, boring, nonsensical, uncomfortable, and filled with fear and anxiety during the entire time you're doing that. And it's terribly confusing. I mean, you're a 19-year-old kid and you're dropped into the jungle and you don't know what's going on. And most of the guys that were there didn't even know where they were. I mean, it's that confusing. So how do you get that across to a reader about boredom and tedium without boring the reader so they throw the book away? You know, I mean, it was a very, that's I rewrote the first chapter 20, 25 times until I finally felt like, I think I've got it to a point where I can still get the essence of what these kids deal with and not lose the reader. That was the tough artistic problem.
And I think you mentioned earlier that the book got published finally was not the book that you had finished 30 years before.
Right.
In other words, and why don't you talk a little bit about rewriting?
Sure. I mean, it's an amazing process. I mean, that's one of the things I love about being a fiction writer, is that you learn yourself through the art. And as I said, when I did that first draft, I was you know, sort of a young, cocky guy, you know. And 30 years of getting beat up by life, you're not so cocky anymore, and you actually do tend to learn some things. And there were some specifics that, for example, the first draft, I was afraid to get inside my African-American characters. They were all there, but I mean, there would be no getting into their characters, because I mean, I'm from a little logging town in Oregon, and honestly, racial tension in my little town was the Norwegians and Swedes against the Finns.
Sounds like the Upper Peninsula.
That's right. Every Friday night out behind the labor temple. Yeah. You know, it's like, by God, we're squaring off tonight. You know, damn Swedes, you know. So anyway, if it had been published back then, it wouldn't have had the richness. And I realized that, okay, it's scary. It's scary to try and get into somebody's skin that you don't have really very much about. So I read every book I could on the African-American experience, and I read African-American writers, and I came up with this thought, which is not at all surprising. It's like, if I really believe that black people and white people are just the same inside, then I can do this. But I was still a little worried that, I mean, I was going to have somebody in an audience, an African-American, you honky, you have no clue about, you know, and I thought, okay, you know. And I thought, well, if I, but you can't write about Vietnam and that time period without writing about racism. That was there. And if you're going to write a true piece of literature, you got to tackle it. So I tackled it. And my characters got deeper and better, but it was a little bit scary. So that was one thing that really worked. The other thing that really worked that was very interesting to me is that I had a lot of anger about, you know, bad officers. I mean, anybody who's been at this level in the military and has seen people at that level, you can understand. I mean, especially if you're out there without any food and, you know, all these, I don't know, how we can't use bad. There's these people that mess up really badly back there. And so, I mean,
We know what we mean.
Yeah, I poured. Probably, I took the traits of bad officers and I put them into my villains. I mean, all novels have to have villains. But I began to understand my quote villains. I actually like them because I began to see that they were people that were in over their heads, and they had the exact same human flaws I have. I mean, one of them's ambitious. Hello, who isn't ambitious? One of them drinks a little too much. Well, that's only 70% of the population. So, I mean, it's like, you know, these are ordinary human flaws. I mean, we've dealt with the, you know, what is it called, the seven deadly sins? I mean, it's just part of the human condition. The difference is that these people were thrown into positions of power where if you make a mistake because you have a hangover in the corporation, maybe if it's a disaster, it's 2 cents a share. But if you're a battalion commander in combat, it's dead kids. And I begin to have this more of this empathy. I don't let them off the hook. You can't afford to have that kind of a flaw. That's why the military is so right about being impeccable about standards of honor, because they understand that it isn't the same as business. It's human lives, and you cannot allow people to make these small errors that kill people. On the other hand, you staff all of the positions right up to the Secretary of Defense and the President with, hello, human beings. And they all have the same flaws that you and I have, and the consequences are enormous. But writing the novel is what sort of cooled me down about being mad at some of these guys. I just went, you know, there, but for the grace of God, I was a lieutenant. So when I made a mistake, there was only, you know, 43 people affected instead of, you know, 4 million. Right. And that wasn't because I was smarter or better. That was just because I was in that position and not in that position. Mm-hmm. So it was a learning experience.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I feel about your book too is that even though the setting is exclusively in Vietnam, it has a feeling of the era about it, especially in Lieutenant Mellis's reminiscences when he remembers saying goodbye to his girl.
Yeah.
I think, and I'm wondering if you would like to read us that. It's one of my favorite passages.
Sure. Yeah.
As the host, maybe I should hold the mic for you.
I can chew gum and do something at the same time. You know, it's like, let's see. Okay. Now, I think I'll have to set this up a little bit for those of you who haven't read the book. The central character is a very young kid, and he talked about him, self-centered in the beginning, named Wayne O'Mellis. And this scene takes place in the middle of the night. They're on a very arduous, long mission. They've run out of food. They've been carrying the dead body of one of their friends for days, and the body is putrefying on them. And it's raining all the time because it's the monsoon season. It's the middle of the night. And few people in our culture actually have ever been in the woods in the middle of the night. And it is dark. I mean, when you say it's dark, you literally cannot see someone right next to you. You can feel their body heat. That's how you know someone's there. Or you can smell their breath. He's there, and he's with his radio operator, who's a kid named Hamilton, who's 19. And another thing I think is hard for people to understand is that, I mean, when I was in Vietnam, I was the second oldest at one point in my entire company when I was just turned 23. All of our squad leaders were 19-year-olds. The average age was like around 18, 11 months, 19, 0 months. That's the age of Marines, and especially in Vietnam. And so these two kids, what do they do in the middle of the night when they're scared, miserable, wet, cold? They start talking about home, and they start talking about their girlfriends. And it reminds Melis of the time that he said goodbye to his girlfriend. And he's just remembering his goodbye. Let's see. He remembered the night Anne told him that she couldn't go along with this weird concept of morality he'd come up with about keeping his promise to the president. It started as a wonderful meal in the New York apartment that Anne shared with two of her friends from Bryn Mawr, both of whom had made themselves discreetly absent. Anne had gone all out, not only with the bacon-wrapped chicken livers and water chestnuts, but with the real French press coffee pot and that she'd brought home from her junior summer in Paris. Melis had never seen one before. He thought that the best time to tell her about sending in his letter to the Marine Corps would be over coffee. There was no best time. Melis found himself standing with an empty coffee pot in one hand and two empty mugs in the other, looking at her beautiful backside. She was wearing the salmon-colored miniskirt that emphasized her small waist and hugged her bottom. The one that she knew drove him wild. "You don't even like the president," she said. Exasperated, she whirled back to face the sink of dirty dishes. "You told me yourself that he's just a manufactured image. It's not like making a promise to a person." "Yeah, but he's the president. American presidents don't lie to Americans." He felt foolish talking to her back. He's like the representation of, I don't know, of the Constitution, for Christ's sake. I swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States. I raised my hand and swore, so help me God. She twisted around, her hand still on the edge of the sink. "You were a high school kid. You were 17. "I was still me." She turned back. "Oh, God," she said to the wall. He looked dumbly at the pot and cups in his hand. Why was she mad at him? It was a sacred oath, and two of the guys he'd gone through training with at Quantico were already dead. "Bueno," she said, still looking at the wall. "Johnny Hartman got his doctor to say that knee he hurt in football would go out all the time. Jane's brother got his doctor to say that he was gay. He said nothing." She let out a long sigh. Her shoulders moved just that little bit back down to where they normally sat. He realized that she'd been holding her breath. She went into her quiet voice, the one that he knew there was no arguing against. "You got into law school. You were deferred. In 3 years, the war could be over, and if it isn't, you'll do your time as a lawyer. People would kill to get to where you are. People are getting killed. Better people than Johnny Hartman and Jane's brother." She turned, this time slowly. She was trembling. The tears welling from her green eyes struck him dumb, made him feel guilty. "Yes," she hissed. "Yes, yes, yes. And you sent in the letter without even talking to me about it. You didn't even think to talk to me about it." A month after that, he was at the basic school in Quantico, Virginia. He found it difficult to write to her, knowing that Marine training was totally foreign to her. She responded infrequently, saying that her new career kept her busy. Once, after he'd been in Quantico nearly 3 months, he called her to say that he could get up to New York on a 3-day pass. She said that she'd already planned something in Vermont. 2 months after that, he had his orders to Vietnam. He called her and said he had to see her before he shipped out. She said okay, but warned him not to plan on spending the night. Beefed up from the training, hair cut to the skull and in the uniform of a Marine second lieutenant, he made the long train ride from Virginia to New York. When he got to her apartment, her roommates told him that she was out on a date. He waited awkwardly, knowing that her roommates were trying to entertain him. Finally, they went to bed. When she got home, she made tea. After an awkward half hour, she told him that he could sleep on the couch, and she went to bed. He'd been so frightened and desperately in need of comfort that he crawled into bed with her anyway. After two uncomfortable hours with her back to him, he gave up on sleep. He got up in the dark and struggled into his uniform in the overheated apartment, the wool sticking to the sweat on his body. She watched him silently. He called a cab and packed his Valpak. When he was folding it together on the floor, he looked up to see her sitting on the side of the bed. She was wearing a long man's shirt. It didn't hide her panties. Apparently, she didn't care. "When's your plane?" 05:30. He wished he hadn't slipped into military time. "You hungry?" He stood up, pulled the Valpak upright, and lifted it. "No. Well, yeah." He couldn't take his eyes off her. He never could. "Bye. Bye." He walked out the door, closing it quietly so he wouldn't disturb her roommates, and went down the stairs. The cab was pulling up when he heard her running barefoot down the street, still in her long shirt. He stood there, paralyzed. She reached him, eyes brimming with tears, and gave him a hug and a quick kiss, and then pulled back. The cabbie had picked up his Valpak and was back behind the wheel, giving them some time. Anne sat down on the curb. "Go on," she said softly, looking across the empty street. "Go." His last view of her was through the rear window of the cab. She was sitting on the dirty curb, bent over, her hands wedged between her face and her knees, shaking with sobs. When they pulled out of sight of her, the cabbie asked, not unkindly, "Going to Vietnam?" "Yeah. Tough goodbye."
I love that.
I like to tell people that the only thing I leave out of that scene from the 60s is the Matisse bottles with the candle wax dripping down the sides.
From the City Opera House, you are listening to an evening with celebrated authors Philip Caputo and Carl Marlantis on Interlaken Public Radio.
Thank you, Carl. That was great. You guys ready to take some questions?
Yeah.
We have some roving microphones. If you want to ask a question, just raise your hand and I'll come to you. And Beth is over here on this side. So, Beth, do you want to get Bob right there? Could you stand up, Bob, so we can...
Yeah, I was just wondering if you've both been back to Vietnam and what you think of the place today.
I haven't, I've been a little bit afraid to. And there's two reasons. One is that, because I'm just... I don't know what would happen to me. And the other is that I actually... It would be like visiting a foreign country for the first time, because I got dropped into the middle of the jungle, and I never saw a Vietnamese village the entire time I was there. I was in the mountains, in the jungle, fighting the regular North Vietnamese army right in the DMZ, and then I got pulled out. And so I'm going like, if I was to go revisit Vietnam, I'd have to go back to, you know, what is essentially I conceive of as a incredibly beautiful national park where the rangers were trying to kill me. And... And so there's not a huge motive, but my friends who have gone back, and especially the guys who did have a very different war, and one that I'm glad I didn't, which is that horrible moral quagmire of, is that, you know, 16-year-old girl walking up to me with a hand grenade in her basket and about to kill me, or is she just going to give me an apple? This is a terrible, terrible position to be in, and I didn't have to face that. And my friends who have gone back have been uniformly there's not been one who hasn't said it's been a healing experience, and how surprised they are at the the Vietnamese people just, I guess they're Buddhists, you know, and it's just like, we're here today, and you know, that's happened a long time ago. Not to mention that about 80% of the Vietnamese population wasn't even alive during that war. And so they have a very different view of it, and it's been very, very healing for some of my friends. And they've gotten involved in building kindergartens. A lot of that of my particular friends are involved in working with unexploded ordnance, trying to clean it out. And so their experience has been really positive.
I've been back twice. I went back in 1990. With several other American writers for about 3 weeks or a month. And then I went back on an assignment for National Geographic magazine in 1999. and I think it was for roughly the same period. Of course, the funny part about my second return was I was supposed to go back to the area that my company had operated in, out in the bush west of Da Nang, I was with my wife, and we had to backpack in there. And I said, I can't believe I'm backpacking in Vietnam.
That's another reason I'm afraid to go back.
56 years old I was at that time, or whatever it was. It was the same experience your friends had. I was surprised at how little enmity there was from the Vietnamese, including the North Vietnamese. I was surprised at how forward-thinking they were. I mean, they wanted to get on. They wanted to develop their country. They wanted to build schools. They wanted to build roads. They wanted to build infrastructure. And they were actually had a lot of those things underway. The war to them was truly in the past. We had this one bizarre experience. I'll never forget it. As we ended up in this village that had been a Viet Cong stronghold when I was there, so much so that whenever we got patrol orders to go anywhere near this village, I mean, everybody would write home, pack their gear, say it's over, because we knew we were going to be ambushed, sniped at, step on a landmine, something horrible would happen, and usually it did. And anyway, so Leslie and I, my wife and I, finally got to this place, and the village chief and his wife welcomed us. They cooked dinner for us. And by this time, when I was there the first time, of course, back in the 60s, it was like something out of a Joseph Conrad novel. I mean, they were lit by kerosene and oil lamps, and now they had electricity, and they had one TV in the village. And it was in the village chief's house, and he would invite the whole village there at night to go watch TV. And so he had also, because Leslie and I were his guests, he said that we had to sleep in his wife's bed. We had to be there, and they had mosquito netting, and it was a typical Vietnamese bamboo bed. So we're sort of lying there together, and the whole ville shows up to watch this Vietnamese soap opera, and they're all surrounded. They're surrounded by us, and here's these two round eyes sitting lying in bed there together, and sort of waving at them. And I told Leslie, I said if CNN comes on, I'll have such culture shock, I'll die right here. And the other experience was that was very, talk about a healing experience. The first time I was back, I was in Da Nang. We made a big tour of the whole country. I was in Da Nang, and we were invited to the Da Nang Writers Club, I think it was called, or the Writers Organization, whatever it was. Anyway, and the head of it was a former North Vietnamese platoon commander. He and I started talking. We discovered that his regiment had fought my battalion in one of the last big actions I was in. We'd actually, fought each other. When we ascertained this, it sounds a bit sentimental, but it was very moving for me, he got this bottle of Polish vodka out, and he says, we're going to drink together. He says, because you and I are brothers in arms. And it was the strangest thing, because before that, I was saying, yeah, if I'd seen you 30 years ago, I would have killed you. And he says, yeah, I would have shot you too, And it was so peculiar to have that. What we had in common was the experience of facing death and leading men under fire at a very young age.
Thank you. We have a question right here. Paul?
You know, you talk about your experience, and it seems like there was such intensity all the time while you're in Vietnam, where you're almost like maybe driving 100 miles an hour, and all of a sudden you come back to America, and you're driving 10 miles an hour, and you're having to sort of live in this new life, and your benchmark would be Vietnam. It seems like that would be quite a hard transition to me. Could you talk about that?
Sure.
No need.
Okay. You basically, when you send a kid to war, you ask him to play the role of a god. It's only the gods that really should decide who lives and dies. Who do you send out front? And that's your friend, and he's going to go if you send him. You're the one that sends him. Or you pull the trigger. This is something that's a very profound difference between humanity and the gods in the general sense. And I've had this thought. If you think about reading of any of the great religious or mystic experiences, they have many things in common. I mean, one of the things is that the mystic is always aware of his own death, of his mortality. The mystic is in the moment, present in the moment. The mystic is aware and actually gets to the position where he values other people's lives above his own. The mystic, generally, they're part of a larger group, the Sangha, the Ula, the church. Every one of those things, every one of them is extant in combat. And I've wondered if it's just the dark side of the same coin. But if you asked a mystic who had had mystical experiences for an entire year to come back and flip burgers at McDonald's, you know, what would that person, I mean, it just would not go. You're asking an incredible amount. So this sense of coming back, I think it's a very difficult transition. And I know friends of mine who are still up in Alaska, and they're not coming back because they just didn't make it. It's very hard to come back. I myself did an awful lot of mountain climbing. I turned over a couple cars because I was trying to, you know, set speed records on back roads. I was still just sort of seeking all that. And even my entire career was international consulting, where, you know, it was always a crisis and there was always pizzas on the top of the table and people sleeping underneath the table and doing other things. And it was just, you know, and I had a hard time. It probably took me about 30 years to finally sort of get it together.
I think that probably like my career for a while after I'd gotten back from Vietnam, I had already begun trying to write A Rumor of War, and I went off and lived in Europe for a while and bummed around there and did this kind of I don't know. I think I thought I was Hemingway or something like that.
Yeah, and, but look at your career.
And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, always.
And up in the you know, the pint-sized papa is what I used to call myself. You know, so but anyway, so I, but then I came back. I'd run out of money and so forth like that, and I ended up for a while working for the sales promotion department of the 3M company, Minnesota Mining Manufacturing, and one of my jobs was to write ad copy for reflectorized products. You know, the stuff that you put in the median strips of highways that shine at night and things like that, And the people I worked with in the office were always talking about whether or not they got their new lawn in, or whether or not the new house was being built. And I almost the Marine Corps phrase for reenlisting is shipped over, and I almost shipped over. I said I can't do this. I said it's more real back there, and. Journalism saved me from doing that, but I ended up becoming a war correspondent mostly and all that. When I think that what I was doing was trying to constantly duplicate the intensity of that experience, which wasn't entirely a healthy thing, but I think that you search through history, the American West was probably settled a lot by Civil War veterans from both sides that just couldn't go back to the farm anymore. So I think that's
I think another thing that's important in that equation is Sebastian Younger pointed this out, and it's absolutely true, is that when you're a 19-year-old kid in combat, you count. If you don't do your job, people die over here. Your friends die. So you are enormously important. There's enormous meaning to your life. And when you come back here, how much do you count? I mean, if you don't show up for work, who cares? It's a very big difference. And so that feeling of I count is no longer with you. You have to gin up some other more esoteric, abstracted way of saying I count. I'm important to my family. But that's a difficult thing to gin up, especially if you're young.
I'm a Vietnam vet, and I went back after 40 years as a healing experience. And I read both of your books. I thought they were fabulous. Thank you. But what struck me about A Rumor of War was the addictive rush of being in combat, and how that's, you know, a real energizing thing for kids that they get hooked on. And what I was struck by yours, Carl, was the whole puppet master thing of the generals in a remote, safe area ordering kids into combat and not seeming that concerned about it. So I understand the anger there, although you were more forgiving than I may be around that. But I wonder, the question is, I wondered, how do the two of you view the differences in experience between the two books and how you approach that?
I'm not quite understanding the question. How did we?
Well, to me anyway, my experience was you were really talking a lot about it, in addition to other things, the addictive rush or thrill of being in combat, and how that gets how kids get caught up in that beyond themselves. And I was really what really struck me about your book was the fact that the generals are sitting back and or colonels are sitting back mm-hmm. in comfortable quarters making decisions about kids schlepping in the jungles from one hill to another that then they arbitrarily abandon 24 hours later. Seems like those are two different experiences. And I just wondered how the two of you saw the differences in themes around the two books.
Go ahead, Phil. I've got an answer. All right.
Oh, go ahead. Good.
I mean, what I actually think is that I and Phil wrote about the same thing. I mean, if you remember in the novel, Melis talks about the mad monkey. Melis talks about giving himself up to the god of war. He talks about this sense of love when he actually goes into combat to help his friends. And I think the only difference is that I did tend to, in addition, focus on this issue of officers who actually never bothered to come out into the bush to find out what was going on. It was one of the things that really ticked us off. It's if you just come out here and try to hump 3 miles, you know, you'd understand how long it takes, but it just wasn't being done. And that was just one of the things that I saddled these guys with. There was a lot of ticket punching, careerism. That was the era. Marine officers today even will talk about that, and they don't like it. I mean, you guys in the Army don't like it. It was a bad time. It was a bad time for the military because of that. I think that they do a better job on that. So I just happened to, in addition to that adrenaline thing, talk about the rear areas. And the difference is, because I'm writing fiction, I can do that. Phil's writing a memoir. He wasn't there at headquarters. He was out in the bush. And so I think that was a big difference between the two types of books that we're writing.
Thank you for listening to An Evening with writers Philip Caputo and Carl Marlantis. For more on the upcoming 2011 season of the Traverse City National Writers Series, please visit their website at www.nationalwritersseries.org. This program was produced by Interlochen Public Radio. This is Aaron Stander.